Good afternoon.
Hello. How are you doing? I always sound like, when I say hello, I always sound like I'm picking it up to like a cold caller. Hello?
Yeah, that's because I'm constantly trying to sell you double glazing.
Yeah, well, I do need it, so.
Yeah, my side business.
Kieran's side hustle, selling double glazing.
Yeah. So what's new?
Not a lot, to be honest. I've had 3 days off this week, which has been very pleasant. I thought I was going to spend it just kind of sat in my pants playing The Last of Us Part 2, but my wife had other ideas and we've embarked on various tidying up and hanging pictures and taking things to the tip, which, to be honest, I don't mind taking stuff to the tip because it's quality in it, trying to throw like microwaves as far as you can.
Is there anything that gives a man a more feeling of power than lifting something up into... just chucking it into the tip? Like when you chuck something into the tip, you got to do it with a bit of force, haven't you? Because the louder you do it, the better it feels.
Yeah, that's it. Or a woman. Let's be equal.
Sorry, yeah, or a woman. But for a man such as myself who's very insecure, a grand gesture like throwing, you know, a dissected wardrobe into a skip, it's just a feeling of power, like an adrenaline rush that you can't get from anything else. I don't know, I've not tried skydiving. Maybe that would be as good. I don't know.
People look at me strange when I like scream as I'm letting go of the microwave as it soars through the air. But it's more like a high pitched kind of.
That's as your back goes out as you're trying to lift a microwave up to chuck it away.
I've done that before.
There's like a weird like tip etiquette though, isn't there? Like you can't just go in and just start chucking stuff anywhere. Like I get a bit nervous because you go in and then the guys are like, you've got to park in the right spot by the right bay, get the right thing in the right skip.
You don't have to park in the right spot. It just means that if you're in the wrong one, you got to walk a bit, haven't you?
Yeah. Which I should not have to walk anywhere. It's an inconvenience.
You got to recycle, man. That's important. It's good to do that.
We've got that field behind us, so I just throw all the rubbish in there. I just think, like, it'll go eventually.
Set it on fire.
Yeah. I heard there's going to be some serious acid rain coming up, so. Side note, what's Last of Us like? I really want to play that.
Very quickly, in one word, incredible. Yeah. It's basically, it's so good that I'd probably think playing the first one now after this would, there's obviously just such a leap between the first and the second one in terms of, graphics and God, it is way more brutal as well. It is immensely gory, but yeah, it's good.
When you were saying you're playing that, but you wanted to play that other, and your wife had other ideas, I thought you were going to say she wanted you to play Call of Duty or something.
Yeah,
fighting over the PlayStation. No.
But you know, playing The Last of Us wasn't even the best thing that's happened to me this week. There's two things that have just both been incredible. The first is that I found Ben and Jerry's the vegan one, which is always way more expensive than the regular one. Down to 95p per tub in Tesco. So I swiped like 5 of those.
That's obscene. Yeah. I wish I'd known about that because...
I know. I'm sorry. I should have told you.
Yeah, yeah. God, that was... Well, I don't think we mentioned on here to everyone that we're both vegan. So that's that.
Yeah.
But I think Ben and Jerry's has kept us going through lockdown. I think every time we've been to Tesco, we get a tub. Probably spent about £70 on ice cream alone in the last couple of months.
Yeah. I think you've got to, though, haven't you? We've had to have something to enjoy over the last few months.
Yeah. What's your favourite flavour?
What's my favourite flavour?
What's your favourite flavour? Oh, tell me.
I quite like the cookie dough with the peanut butter one.
No, you're mixing flavours there.
No, I'm sure there's a Oreo peanut butter one.
There's peanut butter and cookie, and then there's cookie dough.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, it's the peanut butter and cookie one.
Semi-correct answer.
What's yours?
Cookie dough.
It's fine if you like the same kind of taste all the way through, if you're a bit boring.
Do you want to know something that's really sad? Is me and Claire pretty much had this exact conversation last night.
Yeah. God, Kieran, why do you always want pasta with just tomato sauce on it every night?
Why are you eating raw pasta out the bag again? I just like the plainness of it. I feel safe.
Consistency.
Yeah, so it's Thursday today, and the pub's open on Saturday, and then we'll be back in lockdown on Monday. Will you be going to the pub on Saturday?
I won't, but before I tell you why I won't be going to the pub, I need to tell you that second thing that happened. Because
you're only 16.
Because, yeah, I use a voice emulator on here to make myself sound older.
Anyway, sorry, what was your second exciting thing?
The second exciting thing, I really do have to tell you this. I was driving along the road and I'd picked Logan up from nursery, and I was listening to a song, and I can't remember what song it was, but there's two drum beats in it, the kind of music, like all the instruments drop away and there's like two hits of a drum, do, do, and then it goes like right back into it. If anyone knows that song, yeah, feel free to message us. That's enough to go on.
Everyone knows that song.
But I saw these two potholes coming up, and I was like, oh shit, I'm going to ride over these in the car at the exact same time that these drum beats hit. And I did. And it was honestly like, I wish Logan was older than three, because I was trying to explain the satisfying feeling to him, but he just looked at me like I was an idiot.
He'll remember. You don't forget a thing like that in a hurry.
Well, it'll be part of my repertoire, old man stories, when I'm older, so he'd better get ready for it.
You're going to be driving down that road four times a day just for that satisfaction.
Yeah.
But do you know what's really satisfying? What's really satisfying is when you get those like square speed bumps and your car is like the perfect size just to go over it, and you go over it and you don't even feel a bump. But then you get the ones that are like deceptive, and then you don't realize, and then it just smashes the underside of the car.
I once drove to someone's house. It was a very rural house once, and it was really late at night, and it was like a new build, and they'd put speed bumps all the way down the road, but they're those really like nasty, like really angular ones, not like the nice. So what has this podcast become? I'm talking about like the shape of my preference for the shape of speed bumps. And I was doing like 40 mile an hour down this guy's road, because it kind of turns into a bigger road, and just these speed bumps, did not expect them. The lights in my crappy car didn't pick them up, and I nearly just smashed my tires to smithereens.
Nice. I once broke down and had to get the breakdown REC or AA, whoever was with. I had this old car. It was from it was a Peugeot 205, I think it was. It was an old one. It was from 89 anyway. And I discovered that if you put it in first gear or like a low gear as you were slowing down, it made this really cool high-pitched whirring sound. So I was coming to the traffic lights once, and it was about 40. I was on the way back from a gig, actually. It was on the way back from seeing 36 Crazy Fists. And I decided to put it in first as I was slowing down at about 40, and it made this like high-pitched whirring noise. It was amazing. We were all laughing. And then like changing the car just wouldn't move. It was just like creeping forward really slowly. So a little bit of advice. I mean, I'm not a mechanic by any means, but I would suggest not putting your car in first gear when you're doing 40.
Is that your favorite breakdown?
Yeah, that's my favorite breakdown of all time. Yeah. It was brutal.
But going back to the pubs, you live opposite a pub, don't you? So when they reopen this weekend, are you going to go to the pub?
Well, I don't know. I don't know, because they've got a marquee out the back, so they're obviously doing something, and I'm guessing there's going to be hopefully some sort of social distancing measures. But I was kind of thinking that I could just go over, and just because we live opposite and we've been in a few times, they kind of know we live here. Is just say, can I just get a couple of pints and I'll just take them home and then bring the glasses back. I wonder if it was a Wetherspoons, whether you could get them to do that on the app.
I don't know.
How incredible would that be if I'd moved to the middle of nowhere, but it was opposite a Wetherspoons and I was in the middle of nowhere, so I can't get an Uber, I can't get a takeaway delivered, but I could get a pint delivered to my front door. That would be amazing.
That would be pretty good. There are lots of beer companies doing like deliveries now. Lots of people like small brewers, so you might be able to get one off them. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about.
I feel like it's best just to kind of hold off for a little bit, see what happens, and then maybe go to the pub. It's not an essential, is it? You can put beer in the fridge, so.
Exactly, and I was saying before, like, you know, I've got a young son, so my social life is just pretty much dead anyway. So
it's kind popping, of, is what it is.
It's it really is popping. Bed by 9:30. I don't know, it's kind of it's this thing where it's like I wasn't really going to the pub that often before, just because, you know, majority of my mates have kids as well. And then one of my mates who doesn't decided to selfishly move to a relatively small rural town about a 40-minute drive away. that was Kieran, in case you couldn't guess.
I'm not your mate.
Oh.
We've just had a message coming on Instagram from a guy called Jack Foster. McFly signed first record deal for 10 years and he wants to know, when are these guys on the podcast? Well, lucky for him, we're working on that. Maybe a couple of episodes time after Kelly Clarkson.
Yeah. But if we're gonna have a choice, there's no way I'm going for McFly. It's got to be Busted every day of the week.
I don't know. I feel like McFly are a bit more credible. I don't know.
You are joking. Seriously, you would choose McFly over Busted?
Well, I suppose credible is a bit of a odd word to fling around, you know, when you're talking about them two.
So in this episode, we've admitted that we don't eat meat, and we're now talking about whether McFly or Busted are better. Honestly, our subscribe number is just going to be rock bottom.
It's going to drop after today. It's going to drop 50% from 2 to 1.
Exactly.
But we did try and get Kelly Clarkson on the podcast, didn't we? So we mentioned there. It might have just been in the trailer, actually, but me and Graham, oh God, maybe we should save this for another episode, but me and Graham absolutely love Kelly Clarkson's Breakaway album. Yeah. And we thought, how great would it be if she would come on and just have a chat with us, and we could have actually a serious chat about why it's a great album, why us as two metalheads enjoy the album, and just why it's so enjoyable. But we got no reply from her management. But so if anyone is listening to this, Kelly, maybe you're a fan, we don't know. But if you listen to this and, you know, if anyone's got any links to Kelly Clarkson, then, you know, hit us up. Or McFly.
You know, it's the worst timing ever, though, because you were like, oh, I'm going to write this email because, like, it'll be fun. And, like, if she says yes, it'll be absolutely ridiculous, which it will be. And then, like, I was on my phone about 20 minutes afterwards, and there's this, like, news alert that she's getting a divorce.
Yeah, it was literally about 20 minutes, wasn't it? Yeah, nice one, yeah. Oh, Two Metalheads, do you want to come and talk about your album? No, probably not. But we've got a good episode today.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, this is a different one because obviously normally we have bands on. This isn't a band. This is an author, Dan Franklin.
Yeah, so Dan released a book in February called Heavy, How Metal Changes the Way We See the World, which is just a really interesting take on metal.
It's really deep, isn't it? Because, like, it's not just about music. Like, he takes different genres and different bands throughout the chapters of this book and kind of compares them and kind of contrasts them to popular works of literature and art and stuff like that. And this trying to describe this concept of what heaviness is and how you can feel it through different types of media, but especially metal. It's something else. It's really deep.
Yeah, it's some pretty cool sections just about bands and their kind of history as well. So it's a good read. But you were reading this, I think, when we started the podcast, weren't you? So I think Dan was one of the first people that before we started doing interviews on here, was one of the first people that we wanted to come on. So it's great to finally have him on the show.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'd read the first page at that point, and he was talking about losing his wedding ring at Deftones Mosh Pit, and I just, like, found him on Twitter, and I was like, yes, this book is resonating with me already, and I haven't even got past the first page.
It kind of resonates with this podcast. That's what it's all about, isn't it? Going to gigs and worrying about losing something.
Yeah, but we've also got a signed copy of that book, Heavy, and a sweet custom tote bag that we're going to be giving away. We're doing a giveaway on Instagram. But if you stay and listen to the end, we'll tell you how you can enter that.
Don't fast forward. Listen.
Yeah. Soak it all in. Anyway, this is episode 6 of Two Off This Pit with author Dan Franklin. Hello and welcome to episode 6 of Too Old for This Pit. And this week we're joined by Dan Franklin, music writer and author.
Yeah, so Dan released a book this year called Heavy, How Metal Changes the Way We See the World. The book, aside from being a really interesting read, has a really, really impressive list of gigs that Dan's seen in there. But thank you for joining us, Dan. We were just saying before we started recording that the book came out just before lockdown hit.
Yeah, I mean, it was unfortunate timing in some ways. The book came out on Thursday, the 19th of March, which is also my birthday. And yeah, lockdown happened on the 23rd, on the Monday. So, you know, the way publishing works is you get, you know, all your publicity sort of lined up in advance. So I didn't suffer in terms of any of the coverage, really. It got reviews in, you know, The Guardian and Sunday Times and Irish Times. I did a little pre-record for Six Music. So that was good. But you get a certain amount of follow-on publicity, I think, you know, in normal circumstances, which this didn't really get. Plus, bookshops closed. So for anyone sort of wandering in, browsing the music section of their bookshop, they wouldn't have seen my book Face Out. But I think, to be honest, though, the type of book it is, you're going to hear about it and then you're going to go and find it. It's a special interest book.
I suppose that's the nature of things that are heavy, is word spreads around the metal community, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, and it's been ticking away. I mean, from what I can see on Amazon, you know, it's just been kind of ticking away. And I'm hoping that's because people are reading it and enjoying it and just telling their mates about it. And, you know, that works for me. And my objective was, if one person reads this book and, like, it resonates with them, then I'm happy. So, yeah, it's all good.
So for people who haven't had a chance to pick it up, and they definitely should, because it is brilliant, how would you kind of describe it in a very short kind of, you know, phrase?
In five words.
It's an investigation into what heaviness is and why heaviness is so important to metal music and why it makes it so powerful an art form. And then why metal deserves its place in the kind of cultural landscape and how it sort of feeds lots of other types of media, from books to films to theatre to art. But really the central thesis is explores, idea that it explores is, you know, why is this music powerful? And the answer is heaviness. So then the book goes on to explore what exactly is heaviness.
And we were saying just before we started recording that we actually got in touch with Dan, I think even before we had a first episode, because I'd heard about this, the book Heavy, and I picked it up and I was reading it. And in the very first, I think it's the first page, it's definitely the first chapter, you talk about losing your wedding ring in the middle of a Deftones mosh pit. And I was like, that's exactly the kind of thing that some of me and Kieran would do, you know, just like... It's just, nothing speaks more about this podcast than the act of losing a wedding ring in the middle of a pit. And it just, from that page, it was like, oh yeah, this is going to be good. We've got to get Dan on.
The thing is, though, is back in the day when you're a teenager and you go to gigs and you've got a phone and a wallet in your pocket and you think, I don't care if it falls out. I'm not fussed. I'm fine. Whereas now, you know, it's like you're still there the whole time, like pogoing a bit like that. And then you have to go and stand at the back.
Yeah. I mean, so that happened at a gig. It was 2017 in Alexandra Palace when Deftones played there. You know, I saw Deftones, you know, 1997, you know, with Around the Fur, and they've always been one of my favorite bands. And yeah, so this happened. I wish I could remember the song, but yeah, I was sweaty. And then it was sort of in the middle of, you know, one of these sort of raging songs. I was like, oh, fuck, I don't have my wedding ring. And then I felt my pockets. I was like, okay, where are my keys? and then the song stops, and there's like a guy dangling this set of keys, like looking nonplussed. I was like, those are my keys. And then I sort of saw the ring, and like I had to dive to like retrieve it. It was definitely one of those moments which is pertinent to the name of this podcast, where I was like, is this a sign that I should be stopping doing this? But that for me is out of the question, because when I go to a gig, I can go to small gigs and stand and really just take it in and enjoy it. But if I'm going to a big show, I don't feel I'm really like doing the gig all myself justice by kind of standing there. So if I've made it through the first song and it's a band I really love, it's often the second song I'll crack and just go for it. But I have stopped wearing my wedding ring at gigs as a result. I learned my lesson.
I bet, though, the relief when you did find it, I bet the rest, like, how quickly in the gig did you lose it? Because I bet the rest of the gig was incredible once you'd found it, because the relief would have just been unbelievable.
It was during one of the songs that I realized it was gone and retrieved it, you know. I mean, it's just a complete ruiner, the idea of... I did lose another set of keys. I had a spare set of keys, which I sort of hung around to try and find afterwards. It brought back memories when I went to see Korn when I was 15. You know, you're sort of talking about not giving a shit where all your stuff ends up. My shoe came off in the first song.
Oh, that's the worst.
Brixton Academy on the Life is Peachy tour. And the shoe came off. It was like, you know, when you go to a gig and you're 15 and everyone else there is 15, 16 years old, the whole place is popping off. Mm. So it didn't matter. I was like, I can hop. And occasionally, like, touch down my foot. And then afterwards, trying to retrieve the trainer, the place was covered in shoes. I found my shoe as well. I found it. But I wonder if that's still the... Because obviously, you know, being in my late 30s now, I hope that's still the case, that at the end of these gigs, it's just a sea of shoes on the floor.
I can remember, though, when younger, going into gigs and thinking, right, I'm in the pit for the whole thing, and getting Converse and you tie the laces up around your leg or whatever. But it's just, it's all different now. I know now, if I know I'm going to go and jump around, I don't go with my glasses on because I can't see a thing without these. So that's when I put my lenses in. But then it always happens where I'll go to the gig, stand there at the back with my glasses on. Something will happen. I think I need to get in. And then I've got to like find a pocket somewhere for my glasses and just hope they don't break.
Can I just say as well, Kieran, that when you say that, you know, it didn't matter if you lost stuff, you're talking about a time when we were going to gigs when we were teenagers, when a phone literally was like a backlit Nokia 3310 that cost like 50 quid, not the 900 quid now.
To be fair, if you drop one of them, that's probably going to break someone's foot, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
And all you had to do was worry about your mum and dad meeting you outside at 11.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the sad thing now, though, is when you go and see these bands again you were seeing as a teenager. So, like, I went to the Machine Head, Burn My Eyes. It's 25th anniversary gig at Brixton last October. You know, like, there's so many people in between songs who have their phones out with the torches who are just looking for stuff. And then, like, another song starts and you're in a mosh pit and there's still these bricks walking around with their phones, like, trying to teach it. And you think, you are literally old enough to know better than to come in here with, like, loose shit in your pocket. And this is making a mockery of everyone else here because there's like loads of old blokes just looking at the floor for half the gig trying to find whatever they've lost. This is the guy who lost his wedding ring at a Deftones gig. But it did make me feel a little bit sad that. But it was still good. It was still good fun.
So what made you want to kind of write this book? Obviously, you've been into heavy music for a very long time. When did this idea about the book kind of begin forming in your head?
I've been writing about metal music for the website The Quietus for a few years. And I think in my mind, I'd sort of, back in my mind, I was sort of just, you know, rolling it around. Could I do a book? What would that look like? But it started with a piece of writing at the beginning of 2018. I was just getting really into Tool again. You know, for many years, the rumors were swirling around about there being a new album from Tool. And start of 2018, that was really starting to kick up a gear. And there's an excellent YouTube channel called Tool Archive, which has loads of their old gigs on it. So for no real reason, really, I was just sort of diving in and listening to a lot of those gigs. And I was reading these nonfiction books by Aldous Huxley. And one of them was The Devils of Loudun, which was made into the film The Devils. And I just thought, you know, a lot of the stuff he writes about, I thought that was like the story about, you know, so The Devils is about, you know, a Jesuit priest who gets burnt at the stake for supposedly being possessed by the devil, and a nunnery that went mad.
Light stuff.
But Huxley writes about a lot about self-transcendence, and sort of he was writing, you know, he was dropping a lot of psychedelic drugs in the 50s, 1950s. So a lot of his books end up being about more about the sort of psychedelic experience. And that really just, if you listen to Tool and Lateralis and a lot of what Maynard Keenan writes about, those ideas are very, they talk to each other quite strongly. So I thought, well, I quite like to do some writing around this subject, like analyzing Tool songs against Aldous Huxley. And I started writing it, but it wasn't like anything that I could sort of stick up on the internet. I mean, well, I could, but I mean, there's certain things you have to try and achieve with writing for the web, and, you know, that is timely and on the back of something. And this was sort of stretching out to be a longer piece. So I thought, well, maybe this is the start of a chapter in a book. And it was the fact that I was sort of talking about the music in relation to this other writer that I thought this is interesting to sort of do something which puts metal music in a broader cultural context. And then sort of thinking that through, I was like, well, what, you know, you can't just have that. What would be the driving narrative behind it? And I just felt I'd never read anything which tried to ask that question of why, you know. Mm-hmm. Lots of people write the history of metal and or about, you know, the stories of debauchery, but if you read like a sort of typical autobiography or biography of a musician, there's very little, they struggle, I think, to articulate what it is that makes their music so powerful, because the music does the talking. So the idea sort of evolved from that, and I sort of worked it into a proposal, and then I pitched that, got an agent, and then a publisher off the back of that. So it kind of came about organically, nicely. The funny thing about that Tool chapter, I ended up dropping it from the proposal because my agent thought it was a bit too like hardcore. He's like, this will be like in the middle of the book and all the Tool fans will enjoy that. But I don't know if you should use it to try and sell the book to publisher. And actually, when I was writing the book and then editing the book, because that was the oldest piece, I found it kind of the most difficult to go back to again and again. But then Tool released Fear Inoculum, and that was fantastic. That came out, that was last August, end of August, wasn't it? So last year. And you know, the book was in then, and I was able to incorporate a bit of it, that sort of long-awaited album. That's where the origin story of the book came about, really.
I think as well, that's what you talk about, that it's the thing that kind of is different about this book. It's not just an exploration of metal and its surrounding genres as a type of music, but obviously you tie a lot in with different types of literature. This thing that heaviness is a concept. You talk about it kind of early on in the book, and you say that heaviness can be small and insidious, like creeping doubt or fear, but more often it's defined by massiveness and rendered in gigantic and mythic scale that speaks to broad and often uncomfortable human truths. And it's just, it's so great to hear something that I kind of, as you reference in the book, a genre that's kind of been not dumbed down, but hasn't really been explored like this before. And the links that you draw between different works of art and literature and coming back to metal, just, did you feel like you were kind of bigging metal up, and as well as showing how it kind of, this concept of heaviness has been around a long time and relates a lot to different things, did you feel like you were kind of trying to push for people to realize that metal and heavy music is worth this kind of this exploration and this investigation?
I think I've always thought like metal doesn't need this book. You know, metal, the culture in metal is so strong and it's still so popular. But I did think it doesn't need it, but I felt like it deserved it, you know, and I wanted to kind of pay tribute to it. And I thought, yeah, I did think it deserved it, that notion to be brought to a wider audience if possible, because there are great books that have been written about, you know, folk music, or, you know, a book like Electric Eden by Rob Young, and then the post-punk like Rip It Up and Start Again by Simon Reynolds. You know, it's sort of serious books which treat the subject seriously. And I wanted to write quite a serious book about metal music. And, you know, and also see if I could just kind of like claim heavy as a sort of adjective for other things, like, you know, like, you know, and people use heavy anyway, and they kind of know what, instinctively people kind of know what you mean when you say, God, that was a heavy film or a heavy, heavy exhibition or whatever. People instinctively know. So just to try and like put that into words, but I didn't want it to be like, oh, please like metal music, please enjoy it, please take it seriously. Isn't it worthy of it? Because I don't think, you know, metal is enormous. And you saw that with last year with two big coups were Slipknot beating Ed Sheeran to number one, or knocking him off number one, and then Tool beating Taylor Swift to number one in the US. So, you know, it doesn't, it is big, and it doesn't need, and it has a very, like, and it has a very coherent identity. But I just really wanted to share that enthusiasm. And it's a sort of love letter, really, to heavy music and my experiences in it.
I think it's actually probably quite a good book for non-metal fans to read, because I think, you know, we've all been there where, I don't know, you've got a song on and somebody who's not into metal comes in, and to them it's just some angry guy screaming about wanting to kill someone. Whereas obviously there's a lot more substance to it than that, and there's a lot more behind it. So I think in a way it would be a good book for people who aren't into metal to kind of get more of an understanding of it.
Yeah, well, I hope you, I'm pleased you think so. I mean, I hope so. I mean, it's difficult when you're in the bubble to really know. I mean, that's why I wrote about the chapter, you know, was sort of mainly about new metal, and then about Meshuggah and drum and bass. And, you know, my friend Chris was, you know, who I was at school with, we used to go to gigs together, and then he became a drum and bass producer. And, he is a successful drum and bass producer in a group called DC Breaks. And I said to him, look, could I send you a couple of questions about what you see the relationship between what you're doing in drum and bass and why you enjoyed metal when you were a teenager, and if you could connect the two? Because a lot of people, when they get into dance music when they're teenagers who used to be into metal, kind of disown metal and go, oh, you know, it was a phase. But then he has a WhatsApp group with all these drum and bass DJs and producers. And so he's like, he asked them, and you had the guy from Pendulum and the guy from Noisia all came back going, we love metal and we sampled metal. And, you know, so I got to ask them questions as well. So for me, it was kind of, and in fact, it was the non-metal head, like strict, just metal people, who gave some of the best responses about what they saw heaviness as. So I hope people who are curious about the genre, or new people who really loved it. And it's true with my family and friends, they're reading the book and going, I mean, my mum was like, I found it quite emotional reading it, because we've never really talked about what it is about this music that you love so much, because my parents weren't really big rock fans. So yeah, I mean, if it can be a gateway for people, that's great. But there's definitely going to be parts of it which, yeah, are going to go over a lot of people's heads.
You talk about, you know, the metal kind of resonating with people who are in, obviously, making music for a different genre. There's a thing at the moment, I don't know if you're probably aware of this, a lot of rappers wearing like black metal and death metal t-shirts. It's become this like huge trend at the moment. And I've noticed there are there's a lot of hip hop out there that's kind of citing rock and metal as a big influence. The I don't know if you've seen it, the Denzel Curry cover of Bulls on Parade by Rage Against the Machine.
Oh no, I haven't seen
that. That's insane.
My God. It's better than the original, and I can't believe I'm even saying this, but I just think it's got so much energy.
When you see a band covering Rage Against the Machine, before you listen to it, you cringe a bit, don't you? You're like, this isn't going to be good, but that video is unreal. Really, he does it justice. Yeah, it's so good. I have to check it out.
Okay, yeah. Because I do like what I heard about of Denzel Curry's, so I should check that out. Yeah, I mean, there's the sort of SoundCloud generation, rap generation, and sort of kids who grew up listening to emo music, and they've sort of moved into rap, and I've seen that crossover happen. I mean, there's a real, like, that next two generations down are really just, it's really interesting. Like, it's completely mixing everything together. But yeah, I'll check that out. Yeah, that sounds great.
There was, I really enjoyed, obviously there's a lot of, each chapter in the book kind of looks at different bands within different genres and then kind of talks about the kind of the mechanisms of these genres and how these bands operate within them. But there's a really great chapter, one of my favorite, about death metal and just about like how tongue in cheek death metal is and how kind of just so over the top and silly it often is that, you know, people often kind of miss that. And that was just, yeah, I really, really enjoyed that chapter, especially the bit about, there was, I think towards the end of that chapter, you were talking about how, like, and this is something that resonated with me, how the color of album artwork makes that album sound like a color to you. And I was reading that and I was like, yes, I've never ever told anyone else that, but there's that album. You talk about that at the end of it, but you talk about Metallica's Master of Puppets sounding red or Ride the Lightning sounding blue. And I was like, yes, 100%. I get that all the time. Yeah,
it was. That was Elleran Kantor who said that to me. So he's the artist who did Venom Prism's album and Bloodbath's last album. And he's a brilliant artist and sort of does his artwork in what I say in the book, in the sort of style of those medieval Renaissance artists who depicted a lot of kind of cruelty happening to the human body. And yeah, he made that point about the color, sort of seeing the colors when you're listening to the music. And yeah, when he wrote that back to me, I was like, yeah, I totally understood that. And I remember, talking about it actually with my agent, like one of the few things he said about the book was like, oh yeah, yeah, seeing the colors of the album, you know, seeing the colors when you're listening to Master of Puppets and Ride the Lightning. I think it's one of the things that Baroness have done really well. Like, just, they've just gone for the, like, let's just name the albums after colors. There's that synesthesia basically. But like, to your original point, like death metal is just so fascinating because on the one hand, it's extremely blasphemous, extremely offensive. And especially like now, a band like Cannibal Corpse, you know, if a band like Cannibal Corpse started now, I don't know how long they'd survive without getting, I don't know if they'd be policed out of existence now. But death metal sort of protects itself because it's so OTT and so lurid. And I think it plays on real fears around death. But it sort of neutralizes them by making it like just so ridiculous. And that's why I've always loved Carcass in particular, because, well, one, for me, musically, they are the outstanding death metal band. I think Hard Work is just a complete and utter masterpiece. But Jeff Walker is just so dry, so sardonic. Their whole approach of sort of making the songs this sort of like medical journal type language, like really wicked sense of humor in there, very British sense of humor as well, which I think is really important.
And that's a bit as well where he's talking, I think it's Jeff talking, where he's saying that he knows that a number of people who've listened to their music have gone on to work in medicine, and
yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah, like people becoming nurses and vets. And that, you know, that came up in one of the reviews for the books, because the book, when it came, because, you know, coming out during the pandemic, the reviewer really kind of like honed in on that. Like a genre which is obsessed with the destruction of life has gifted us an enthusiasm for saving it. It's just like all of these kind of lovely contradictions within metal, unexpected kind of delightful things that it produces. And, you know, it's also because a lot of people who like metal are very, like, well-balanced. I think, you know, we can talk about this, but I think if you're really into metal, you are, to some extent, getting vicarious thrills, you know. And so it didn't surprise me. The other quote I loved from him was watching that documentary. He talks about watching a documentary about the Highways Agency and about someone, how they had to close one motorway because someone was threatening to throw themselves off a bridge on the motorway.
Yeah.
And like everyone getting so bored in their cars, they basically kind of got to the point where they were cheering him on so that they could like get, and you know, that for me again is like, it's so garish, such bad taste, so funny. You know, that is just tonally exactly where Carcass kind of sit, you know.
Although you do talk as well about the kind of, there was a, that you talk about a study on death metal fans versus non-death metal fans to see if death metal fans are more messed up in the head. And both sets of people, the people who weren't into it and the people who were played Eaten by Bloodbath, while shown violent images, contrasted with Pharrell Williams' Happy. I agree with you that when you say that Pharrell's song's more likely to provoke sensitive listeners into acts of cannibalism. 100%.
Yeah, exactly.
It's quite a bold claim.
Well,
it does make sense. I mean, you know, metal fans, I think I agree with you about them being maybe a bit more stable, or because the metal is a positive thing at the end of the day, isn't it? You know, and again, going back to kind of the outside view of it, you know, if you're listening to a song about someone, you know, singing about death or violence, or from an outside perspective, it can be quite a shocking thing. But really, you know, you're kind of listening to it and you have your take on it, and it becomes a positive thing for the listener.
I was just going to say, when you talk about the misogyny bit, I was really glad that you put like Venom Prison in there. You know, this, it's obviously, as we say, death metal, as you said, death metal's had a really kind of bad history of just putting down women. And I think, you know, metal's got a problem. Metal's got a lot of problems, and that's one of them. So it was really good to see Venom Prison in there, because they are fantastic. And it's just nice to see that you also kind of balanced it out with some female representation as well.
Well, going back to Kieran's point, I mean, that, you know, I think you're right. I mean, it's definitely, metal music has therapeutic qualities, I think, for people. You know, some of the sort of mental health specialists I interviewed for the introduction of the book, Dr. Charlie Baker and Dr. Kate Quinn, you know, they, you know, heavymetaltherapy.co.uk is just about that. It's for people who, you know, it's kind of maybe have schizophrenic episodes and sort of are able to use metal music as a way of negotiating with that side of themselves, which is encouraging them to harm themselves. And, you know, so, and this is, idea is developed in the book. That's the sort of medical offing point. But for me, that's, you know, with metal, it starts with Black Sabbath, the song Black Sabbath. It's about the dark figure, the shadow that stands at the end of your bed. And that idea of the shadow self, I think, is like, for me, is really compelling. And that you're externalizing and displacing and grappling with elements of your character. I mean, like, not everyone is going to go and see a band and be like, I need to go and see this band tonight because I need to like wrestle with my demons in a live audience. But I do think there's a strong element of that. And a lot of people talk about metal being cathartic, and I think that's a similar process. And to talk about, you know, going back to talk about Venom Prism as well, they, you know, Venom Prism in their own right, regardless of having a woman on vocals, are a really brilliant new metal band. But the way that they're sort of inverting a lot of the tropes around, you know, a lot of the misogyny that comes with death metal, I think, is, you know, really refreshing. And the way they use more broadly mythology as well. Larissa Stupas is really good at working in sort of those sort of bigger themes and old characters from history. So, you know, they are, yeah, they're a breath of fresh air. And I think have a big future.
So aside from obviously extreme lyrics, there's a couple of sections where, well, there's two sections really in particular, one where about Phil Anselmo from Pantera, yes. And obviously some of the views that he's expressed, yes. Which are obviously quite controversial. And there's a bit about Ian Watkins as well, who, again, yeah. We don't need to talk about, we all know what happened there. What are your thoughts on distinguishing the artist from the personality? Do you feel that if someone has done something bad or has, you know, conflicting views to your own, but they're writing great music, does that affect the music for you, or would that put you off listening to it?
I mean, you know, in the book, I include what, you know, someone asked this, asked Nick Cave this, and his website, The Red Hand Files, and it was a Morrissey fan wrote to him saying, you know, I was a huge fan of the Smiths. I'm not a fan of who Morrissey is today. How do I reconcile this person with this music that I love? And Nick Cave wrote a really, really interesting response and said that once an artist releases music into the world, they sort of cease owning it and it becomes yours. You know, when you experience that music, it is yours. So you've taken it from them, and that is your music now. So you don't need to worry about who that person goes on to become, because so I do feel that way. Well, talking about Phil Anselmo first, because I interviewed him for the book. There's a sort of war being waged within Phil Anselmo, I think, around, which has been going on for many years, and it involves his sense of self and his struggle to kind of define himself, dealing with a lot of injury, drugs, and then tragedy in the context of Pantera. And I was thinking about this earlier, because obviously with the Black Lives Matter movement, it sort of made me think about that section again and the bit I wrote about Primitive Man. Because, you know, he came out and he screamed White Power at a gig, and prior to him screaming White Power in one of the earliest songs, A New Level, he throws a Zeke Heil, you know. So and that was all documented. And he was heavily inebriated, but that was that, you know. And he had some sort of strange spurious excuse about it being an in-joke about white wine backstage. And obviously it caused a huge controversy. But I was thinking about it, you know, his surrogate father figure was Emmanuel Stewart, the boxing trainer. You know, when I was talking to him about this idea of having to be the Superman, he mentioned Mike Tyson. So it's almost like idolizing these black people in his life and somehow maybe not being able to reach that ideal that he kind of strives for, and how maybe that sort of, because it's happened a couple of times publicly, yeah, with the white supremacy thing, whether that is him sort of just lashing out almost at himself and not being able to get where he wants to be in terms of those sort of heroes of his. But I can't, the thing is, the chapter asks more questions than it answers, because like I said, I can't know this man, you know. I can only see his public face, and I spoke to him. And like I say, it's complicated by the fact that I think he is like metal's greatest ever front man. And Pantera were massively influential. And they've also got all this complicated history with the Confederate flag and the Rebel South and all this stuff, which has not aged well. and also someone who is, I think, you know, for a lot of his life, his career being a lot of personal pain, but that doesn't excuse what he did. And I went to see the Illegals last year with Raging Speedhorn supporting them, weirdly enough. at the Underworld, and it was just an interesting experience because, you know, it was like when I went to see Emperor Reform with their former drummer Faust, who'd murdered a guy and served his time in prison and come out. I remember watching that gig and thinking, I'm watching, you know, this guy, he was a convicted murderer, but he's done his time. But he's, you know, it's complicated. In the case of Ian Watkins, it's less complicated for me because I never liked Lost Prophets. so the fact that this singer turned out to be like this heinous paedophile, you know, didn't make any difference to how I regarded the band, really. Yeah. But but in seriousness, I did think it was sad seeing, it was the extremity of what he did was, it was so sick that I think it kind of actually almost, like that sort of Nick Cave response, artists are, it almost like even fucked that up.
Yeah.
Because there were people with Lost Prophets tattoos who, the extent of what he'd done was so bad, it was completely irretrievable. It was unconscionable. But I don't think anyone should be ashamed of having a Lost Prophets tattoo or even listening to their music now, you know, because that was, because what you listen to is, you know, you have that relationship with that music. Unless you are someone, this is not going to be a very rare case of someone who got into them after he went to prison, because I don't think anyone would have done that. But I am, there's only really a passing reference to him in the book because, just because of, you know, his kind of the context Lost Prophets were in that period around the late 90s, early 2000s.
We're having a bit of a discussion, me and Graham, before about these, you know, questions, and we got to this section and we thought, you know, do we want to name drop Ian Watkins, you know, or do we want to just kind of brush it over and just ask you the general question? But then there's obviously that section where you're quoting Rob Flynn from Machine Head saying that the metal community tends to brush things under the carpet, you know, and for Phil Anselmo, for example, you know, just kind of brushing aside that he's had these controversial views and he's done these controversial things at gigs. We thought, well, no, we're like, why should we? You know, it should be mentioned. It shouldn't be kind of hidden.
No. Well, and what are your guys' thoughts on that issue of the art and the artist?
Well, when I was reading the Phil, because I'll be honest, I knew about some of the Phil Anselmo allegations or whatever you want to call them, but I didn't know it in that much depth.
Yeah.
So I was reading it and obviously I was quite shocked by it, but I like the fact that you finished the chapter by saying he's still the greatest frontman in metal. So for me, someone like him, obviously, whether or not he has those views or had those views or still has those views, I still really enjoy Pantera. And you watch videos of Pantera live and he is, you know, he's like, he's a beast. He's a great frontman. But I think for me, the Ian Watkins side of it, I've tried to listen to him because I did enjoy the old stuff, but I find it quite difficult. And I don't know. I find it quite difficult to listen to just because it's just horrific what he did.
Yeah.
It's something I kind of, yeah, I've wrestled this a bit. I really struggle with it. I find it really taints the music for me. I don't listen to music and expect to have kind of a, you know, a personal connection or relationship with the person producing it. But I feel like there's just this, when I have tried to enjoy music that's kind of, you know, something's happened that's controversial. I find it just tarnishes it. And I just find it really hard to kind of remain into. But at the same time, I also realize that I'm a hypocrite because I can't stand Tom Cruise and I still like Tom Cruise movies. So I've no idea. I've got some double standards, I think.
Well, I mean, you only have to think for a second about what might have happened on the tour buses of loads of these bands with young women and young men, and you know, you don't need to think too much about the various scenarios that could be in there, and it's just kind of you have to make decisions based on your kind of personal ethics, your boundary lines on you know, where you draw the line on this kind of stuff. I mean, the first Salmo chapter is really just, it was an attempt to, I didn't want to, just got to think carefully here. I didn't want to stand in judgment of someone, but when I didn't have all the facts to hand. But on the other hand, I didn't want to let him off the hook either, because you shouldn't be let off the hook for that kind of thing. And, you know, and it was just for me to work through that as a fan who'd been very upset by what he did, you know. And, you know, feeling in a way, as you do as a fan, like betrayed when... But knowing already that this was not a perfect individual and what the band stood for was not necessarily something that I completely bought into, but I traded that off with, I thought, a lot of the, you know, remarkable kind of exploration that he does in his songwriting about kind of personal torment, which I've always thought is, you know, just so raw and interesting. You know, he's someone who's like by demons be driven, you know, that is kind of, and he was very open about that. So, and at the same time, it's not like he double, you know, the complicated thing about him was he's not like doubling down on racist views. It's confusing because he, you know, that it sort of springs out, in the like two particular moments. Very well documented moments in the 90s and then a few years ago. And it doesn't tally, you know. So, yeah, that you know, it was my favorite chapter to write that. And it was, you know, because it's, you know, the Pantera story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it's just so much going on with that story and with the band.
I think as well, kind of throughout the book, you really get the impression that the bands you're writing about are bands that you love or have loved. Yeah. There's no kind of, you're not straining to put that across. It's really naturally, not just a love letter to metal itself, but in a lot of cases to these bands too. Were there any that you kind of wanted to put in, but you either weren't able to marry up with something else, or it just didn't fit?
You're 100% correct. That, I mean, the one criteria really for any band going in was I had to like them. So it is a very personal book. But I think if you try and write something where you're trying to please everyone, it would just be a weird fudge. So, and you know, if I'm, and a lot of the reasons why I may or may not like a band are difficult to pin down, you know. So yeah, I was always like, you know, I think if I'd really loved a band, then it'd be, you know, evident, and you know, it would really work on the page. In terms of bands that I love, there's so many bands. I guess, you know, there's bands that I kind of like talking about Bloodbath. You sort of touch on Opeth. And Opeth are one of my favorite ever bands. You know, so talking about the bigger bands, like a band like Opeth, band like Mastodon, they're not very, there's not kind of much in-depth stuff on them. I'd love to have done a bit more on them. I did kind of do, I kind of gave everyone I wanted to a fair hearing. There weren't any sort of major omissions where I thought, oh, I missed them out, but I can't remember right now. I bet I'll think of one as soon as we stop speaking.
Was there any new bands or artists that you discovered along the way that you've not heard before?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Interama are one that, you know, kind of came out, you know, well, that was 2016. I kind of got into them. Paradise Gallows. Yeah. Oh, well, I guess of newer bands, Code Orange are probably the one of the best ones that I like at the moment. I think they're so interesting for me because they're just combining, you know, they wear Fear Factory, Pantera, Type O Negative t-shirts. They're really into their Nine Inch Nails, but they've got their industrialized hardcore sound, which is very much their own thing. There's a lot I can kind of appreciate about what they're doing because they're like a generation younger, but are listening back to all the stuff that I loved growing up and that I write about a lot in the book. So it would have been nice to have worked there. In fact, I didn't really write about, I guess there's like a bigger mission. So I didn't write about industrial music at all. So, you know, they, what I already touched on them. So Nine Inch Nails, Code Orange, Ministry, that kind of series of bands didn't really, no real reason for that. I could have done that, but I just didn't feel it sort of fit as well. And that whole sector would have been, it would have been cool to write some more about that. But yeah, Code Orange and then like Oathbreaker were, you know, I don't think they're really doing anything at the moment, but, but you know, the younger bands, Venom Prison, Oathbreaker, A Conjurer, who I know you guys are fans of, I really love that band. And I think, I think they have a lot in common with Carcass and Napalm Death in terms of their, the way they perform, I think is sort of back, is back to a kind of very British extreme metal, which it just works for me big time.
I was just going to say, you did as well get a mention of your own band in who formed when you were younger. Is it Orcus? Is that
Orcus? Yeah.
So, and you named it after an exotic type of orchid, but it's also the Latin word for testicle.
Yeah. Well, they were like, you know, we did that band at uni in Edinburgh. Loved it. Loved playing in that. That was the sort of three piece. I played bass. But that was in the context talking about Caius, and I, you know, those were, you know, one of those bands. Yeah, I remember the first time someone played me Caius was like New Year's Eve. We were around at parents' friend's house and their son was like a year or two older than me. I was probably 12. And he put on Welcome to Sky Valley and with that song with the false stops in it. I was like, this is just, what the hell is this? Is amazing. So I did that with my friend Hal, who I was in the band with when we were, and he liked classic rock, like Free and Jimi Hendrix. So I said, well, you should listen to this band. And that's, you know, that Caius is just one of those bands. Talking about bands where you can bring non-metal fans in, and obviously Queens of the Stone Age is an evolution of that, which is just enormous.
Yeah.
And the interviews with Josh Homme and Dave Grohl, and there's a quote, I think, from John Paul Jones. I interviewed them, Crooked Vultures, in Edinburgh in about 2009, I think it was. So that's, I had all that material. We were pitching like a radio documentary about them, me and a friend who's a producer, radio documentary producer. And we just kind of blagged an interview with them. I rang up Sony Columbia and I said, oh, we're going to make a documentary for Radio 1 about them, Crooked Vultures. Can we interview the band, please, when they're in Edinburgh? And because no one wanted to interview them in Edinburgh, they were like, yeah, sure, go to the Balmoral Hotel. So I had all that material. And we didn't, you know, we did the documentary and it didn't get picked up. And so, yeah, they, big Josh Homme is always kind of another larger in life, complicated character. He's made a lot of mistakes, but yeah, just in terms of like when I was in a band, yeah, that was the sort of side of things we were leaning towards.
Are you still playing now, or is that something of the past?
That's in the past. It's in the past. I've got the bass, you know. I mean, yeah, no, that was fun while it lasted.
But that you're still obviously very much, regardless of whether you're playing, very much in love with this music. And I don't want to go into it too much, but the last chapter in this book was, yeah, it kind of made me a little bit emotional in a way that I didn't think it was going to, but just the bit where you're talking about, there's a couple of bits. There's the bit where you're talking about going to the scrapyard after your car was hit by a lorry while your wife and son were in it, which must be terrifying. And thankfully they're okay, but the bit where you're talking about going to the scrapyard for 2 days with a wrench to try and smash open the CD player to get your type O negative CD out.
Yeah.
And the bit where you're kind of talking about, you know, kind of who metal is for and why people like metal. There's a quote in there about, you know, if self-doubt and disillusionment with the world around you has ever plagued your mind, and about heavy music kind of being a place of to find refuge. And it just, yeah, it's so well written. And it just kind of, I was towards the end, I was just kind of, yeah, made me a bit emotional. I was thinking it's just, it's nice to see that summed up, that feeling of, you know, what we listen to and what we enjoy as fans of this type of music is just so much bigger than audio. You know, the fact that you're there at a scrapyard trying to prize a CD out of the, which I think automotive tomb you described it as.
It's quite a metal thing in itself, yeah. Isn't it? A mental picture.
That's my new band. But that image of you trying to prize that out, because obviously it was the music you listened to when you first brought your son back from the hospital when being born.
Yeah.
It's just, it ties so nicely into that thing of, you know, what we listen to is so, so, so much bigger than audio. It ties into everything around us.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, that particular, so the album was the least worst of Type O Negative, which is classic title, best of. And yeah, my son was born in late October. He was born on the 30th of October, 2015. And we used to listen to, my wife like comes to gigs with me and so on, and she's like, she'll listen to metal in the car a little bit, but she really clicked with Type O, like really liked it. And I left her in the hospital and I drove home to get a few hours sleep, and it was like October the 30th, 4 a.m. Like, it was October Rust atmosphere, and I listened to that song, I Love You to Death, and it's got that lyric, Am I Good Enough for You, in it. And that, when you're listening to that pre-kids, or, you know, when you think, you're often thinking that in the context of a relationship. And then obviously that song just had a completely new dimension to it. When my wife and my son, who was then like 9 months old, was in the car crash, I was like, there is this CD which means so much to me, which I need to retrieve. Because it was in a situation like that where you get a phone call, and it was my mother-in-law saying, B's been in a car accident. I was in Cambridge at the time, and she was down in, you know, Hampshire, where it happened. You know, you're so out of, you have so little control on it, that getting that CD back was like my, like, reclaiming control of that situation. And getting, it was this like old school 6 CD changer. Funnily enough, the other album, another very emotive album, which came out around then, was the Gojira album, Magma. Which is very powerful for reasons which are quite hard to pin down, actually. And I was listening to that as I was like in the hire car, like going back. And I had to go on 2 successive days because I was trying to work out a way of getting the thing out. Anyway, I recovered it. But, you know, I mean, what you're talking about, I mean, talking about this situation we're in at the moment, I do think if you're a metal fan, that metal is really well equipped to get you through, to give you the tools to help understand and get you through like the sort of global catastrophic situation that we are facing with at the moment. And one of the things that I'm doing is just getting out and walking and listening to music, you know, every day if I can. And I listen to music anyway, every day if I can, but I understand that for me, it is such an important part of me keeping it together. Like, you know, my personal circumstances are okay. You know, I'm comfortable. I'm very, very lucky, you know, to be in the situation I'm in, but you just feel the drumbeat of unease around us all the time around this. And it's, again, it's like, it's so out of our hands. And I find that heavy music is just able to, it's just, there's a toolkit there. If you want to use it, I think that can really help. And so, funnily enough, so the book came out and lockdown happened, and it was almost like lockdown put into practice a lot of the stuff that I'd sort of been theorizing about in the book. Like, it really kind of confirmed to me what it is that I find valuable about it. So, yeah, amen to that.
It's interesting you say about getting the CD back being as your way of controlling the situation. And I've never thought about it like that, but now you said that, that makes sense. You know, for me, if, you know, if I have a bad day or something particularly bad happens, the first thing you think about is putting music on. And there's usually a song somewhere in the bank, somewhere in there that maybe, you know, you keep on reserve, and then that's when you dig out when you're feeling this particular way. And I suppose that's your way of getting control of the situation, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of assigning that song to that particular emotion. So it's quite an interesting way of putting it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, talking about a band, I with bands I couldn't go in much detail with, I only really gave them sort of a tip of the hat. But Life of Agony, you know, River Runs Red, that album is just... You know, your parents have split up, listening to This Time by Life of Agony is just like, it, you know, for a band to come out in the context of hardcore and sort of sing about the very like complicated relationship with your father, you know, that music can really like sort of rescue you in those situations, you know.
And that's something I really got from this book, because like I'd never actually thought about this properly, but thinking about it, I love heavy music because it makes me feel something. And and from this book, one of the things that I took away is that, you know, this book is a celebration of feeling something. It's kind of metal is staring head on at a moment or a situation and not flinching and just feeling whatever comes to you. And taking that in your stride, and I think that's such an important message. I'd never thought about kind of what exactly is it that attracts me to heavy music. Why do I get so much from it? And yeah, throughout the pages of this book, that was answered for me, and that was really satisfying.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. I think, you know, next year, like the Download Festival, all the gigs will be very emotional occasions. Yeah. A lot of pent up emotion.
A lot of wedding rings getting lost.
Yeah. Yeah, take them on.
Yeah. Well, but, I want to ask you about new metal.
Yeah.
So we actually, our first episode of this podcast was about new metal itself and kind of our love of new metal when we were teenagers growing up and coming of age. So you mentioned the book New Metal. Well, you described new metal as being pop with distorted guitars, which I can't argue with at all. I think that's quite an appropriate description of it. But obviously for us, I mean, me and Graham were in our teens when new metal came out, and that served as kind of a step towards a more mature taste and getting into more, you know, mature, I don't want to say credible music, but kind of like, you know, growing up and that kind of opened up other doors to us. So I was wondering, even though you kind of describe it as pop with guitars, and obviously there's a bit of a negative connotation towards new metal anyway, do you still see it as a positive movement in music, or is it?
Yeah, I should clarify that. I saw the sort of pop with distorted guitars as this, as I'd say, the sort of second mini wave of new metal. So, you know, POD, Papa Roach, Alien Ant Farm, you know, I was way less keen on those bands who really cracked the charts, you know. And I did feel were much more in line with pop music. And that's not necessarily a diss. It's just I didn't think, my key point in the book is I don't think they're heavy bands, you know. They're sort of trading in something else. I don't think it's bad necessarily. It's just different. You know, new metal was like a massive part of my growing up as well. And I won't put it down, you know. I think what I like and explore in the book, talking about Donington in 1996, are the bands that are sort of the proto new metal. So Fear Factory, Demanufactured, the first Korn album. I know Korn are like the ultimate new metal band, but the first Korn album was before they, I think Life is Peachy became, they fully inhabited that that kind of genre. You know, the first and second Limp Bizkit albums. You know, before it all got kind of properly locked down as new metal, I think there was lots of amazing music there. And then Slipknot came along and just kind of took it all to the nth degree. And then you get Iowa, for me, Iowa and Toxicity, like the two like masterpiece new metal albums.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, and I think like really defined an era, you know, for that generation that grew up listening to that music, and then it sort of fizzled out. You know, so, and you know, there's definitely like, you know, seeing Limp Bizkit and Korn and all these guys still doing the rounds.
Mm.
It's very, you know, it's very valid what they did. You know, I don't, that's why I didn't want to do in the book, was just sort of say, that's good, that's shit, that's good, that's shit. Mm-hmm. Cause it's just like, anyone could write a book and have complete, like just invert everything that you just said, you know, it's just pointless. So yeah, I thought a lot of really strong music came out of new metal. Some of it very, very heavy, like the, like, you know, what Korn and Slipknot did with emotion in heavy music was unprecedented. And then a lot of what I'd say was not very heavy music.
Mm. I know what you're saying. I think with, you know, the first Korn album and the first Limp Bizkit album, there's still a bit of kind of rawness to it. And whilst, I mean, I suppose you could say that some of the first Limp Bizkit tracks are now maybe a little bit cheesy, but there's still kind of anger and rawness to it.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, listen to Counterfeit off the first Limp Bizkit album compared to Nookie. I mean, you know,
I suppose it's a lot less polished, isn't it? So maybe, I don't know whether it's maybe they got a bit of money behind them and then became commercial. I don't, you know, the old thing, but
I think Significant Other's still a really fat album because Wes Borland really, really knew what he was doing on guitar. Mm. You know, a little like Stephen Carpenter from Deftones. You know, they really knew how to riff, those guys. Mm.
And Significant Other is the last, we talk about this all the time, because I consider that basically my cutoff point for Limp Bizkit. Like, it's the last album, the last Limp Bizkit album before Fred goes full whine. Like, he doesn't, his voice isn't that like high-pitched, whiny, annoying. Oh, I just, after that, it grates on me. But Significant Other's got, there's some great songs on that album.
In a way, I feel bad for Wes Borland because I feel like his career has been a bit kind of, he's kind of lived behind Fred Durst, hasn't he?
Whereas
he is like, he's such a good guitar player and he's so inventive.
Particularly,
I don't think Significant Other in particular, actually. Yeah, there's a lot of really inventive guitar lines in there, but.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
One thing as well, just kind of before we wrap up, one thing that I really enjoyed that took me way back was when you were talking about discovering Type O Negative through a song that was on a CD that came with Metal Hammer.
Oh man.
I miss those CDs so much. We were talking in the previous episodes about how kind of, you know, the way we used to discover music was so organic, and the way we used to buy music was just that. But oh man, those Metal Hammer CDs, I've discovered so many bands. The first AFI song I ever heard was on one of those. Cosmonaut by At the Drive-In was the first At the Driving song I heard, and that was on one of those. I feel like there needs to be some kind of, I don't know, if they came back with them, I'd 100% buy them.
I think they have to start giving out CD players with the magazine nowadays.
Yeah. They were, I mean, what a way to sample, you know, music. Mm. But I used to listen to, you know, the radio, XFM and Radio 1 Rock Show. I can remember hearing Hatebreed, The Haunted, Seven Dust, you know, I remember the first time I heard all those bands in particular, they really leapt out, you know, and doing my homework and listening to Ian Canfield, to XFM. But I also discovered loads of cool shit through YouTube algorithms now. Mm. The more things change, the more they stay the same. It's all good.
Well, thank you for your time. I think we've probably taken enough of it, but yeah, I really appreciate you coming on. And for everyone listening, if you haven't read Heavy, please go out and get it. It's, you will not be disappointed. It's such a good exploration of the music that we all love and kind of, you know, enjoy so much. And thanks for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Cheers, Dan. Much appreciated. Thank you.
Well, thank you, guys. Thanks for being so kind about the book.
It's all from the heart. It's genuine. It's nice. Like you said, when you get to write about bands that you really love. Obviously, you know, we kind of wanted you on here because it's a great book, and it's genuine. So So thank you.
Check it out. So that was Dan Franklin on Too Old for This Pit.
Yeah, really interesting guy and a great book. If you haven't read it, do go out and buy it. It's well worth your time. But we also have a giveaway that you can enter to win a signed copy of it and a tote bag.
Yeah, so all you need to do is head over to our Instagram page, which is at Too Old for This Pit. That's 2TOO, not the number 2. The giveaway is up on there. All you've got to do is like the page, tag a friend, and we are going to be picking a winner on the 14th of July at 9 a.m.
Yep. So if you're listening to this after the 14th of July, unfortunately, you have missed out.
Yeah.
You hit snooze and you lost, as the popular saying goes. But let us know what you thought of the episode. You know, we love to see comments, feedback on social media. Tell us what you think, and we'll see you for episode 7, which is Dan Nightingale from Conjurer, which we're really excited about as well.
Mm-hmm.
Let's end it now.
Yeah, on that note. See you later, Graham.
Bye.
Bye.